It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Socially Distant Sports Bar. It's our little way of keeping our love of sport going during this time of corona. We have set up a bar. It's a metaphorical bar at the moment, but hopefully it will become a real bar as and when we're allowed to leave our houses. Ellis is in his branch of the bar. Mike is in his as well. We bring a few clips from YouTube for us to talk about, a documentary and 3 books will be coming your way before the end of the episode. Ellis, how are you this week? All good?
Very good. How are you?
Not bad, mate. Not bad. Yeah.
I don't drink a huge amount. Or I don't drink as much as I used to.
Yeah.
And I had a few glasses of wine with my tea. And I was starting to get quite drunk. I thought I'm too drunk to do the socially distant sports bar.
Can I just say, well done on saying tea, not dinner.
That's your start point. That is good.
So I helped myself to my Easter egg to try and sober myself up.
You've basically done a garage run.
Yeah.
The socially distant equivalent of nipping to the garage late on.
But what a fantastic mix as well. The red wine and a Cadbury's cream egg Easter egg. Superb.
I've just been drinking my cider. Funny enough, just to take the taste of Easter eggs out of my mouth.
We've been keeping a lot of people entertained over the last couple of weeks. Thank you for all the nice feedback we've had. A lot of you having runs listening to us, beers in the garden, barbecues, baths, which is a bit weird. And a few of you doing proper good work as well in the world. Quick hello to Stokey Dad 1. Who is a child protection social worker and in his spare time is also volunteering as a healthcare assistant at the Nightingale Hospital.
Good man.
Combining good job with good spare time job as well, although his wife thinks it's to try and escape the children and the homeschooling. Gitter Ellis Williams been in touch as well, who
good name.
A healthcare Scottish assistant. That is as Welsh a name as you're ever going to get, I would have thought.
Oh, yes.
I was just going to say, although when I worked in the civil service, I used to work share a desk with Gitto from
Gitto Price, who was one of my heroes and told me just before the Wales-Russia game in Toulouse during the Euros that I was his favourite Jack. Well, favourite Jack. I think it might have been the only Jack he liked. But
Did he come to see you? Did he make a special effort to come and see your Edinburgh show 2 years ago?
No, he didn't. No.
He came to see mine.
All right, then 1-0 Bubbins.
So Gitta will be a qualified nurse after completing his hours as a student nurse, hopefully at the end of May. He's working hard now.
Good man,
and Alex Griffith also been in touch, part of the Brecon teaching community, who are on a rota to ensure that key workers can access their roles effectively. So a shout out to all the teachers who are still working through this all as well.
We haven't got any listeners who have immoral jobs.
I hope we have.
There are no hedge fund managers or people who work in the arms trade.
If you make landmines, you please get in touch with the show. Yeah, you work in a wet market in China. We'd like to hear from you, please.
At Distant Pod. First clip for this week, then. This goes to, looking through the list, this one's going to Alice. Clip number one comes to Al.
This is an infamous rant from the Channel 4 documentary Leighton Orient Club for a Fiver, which was first broadcast in 1995. Now, Leighton Orient were a complete basket case of a club. Their owner, Tony Wood, had lost his coffee business because of the Rwandan Civil War. So the club was losing £10,000 a week. Now, I went to Brisbane Road with the Swans just after this period. So, you know, they weren't a club that could afford to lose £10,000 a week. They were hemorrhaging money to try and cut costs. They only had a squad of 13 players whose wages were being paid by the PFA. And they couldn't buttress the squad with loan players because there was an 8-month transfer embargo. I could be wrong. I don't think anything like this really had been on telly before. I know that the documentary I chose a fortnight ago, Graham Taylor, An Impossible Job, was broadcast about a year previous. Now, Sitton had quite a good career as a footballer. He'd played for Chelsea, he'd played in the top five divisions of English football. I think he'd been on the books at Arsenal. I think he'd played for West Ham as well, and had played for Orient between 85 and 91. It was his first senior management job in football. It became his last. The clip I've chosen has become legendary. I think most football fans have seen it, but they are losing to Brentford. The players aren't listening to him. They're not following his game plan, and the following happens.
Good players all the time. Don't you know how profound that is? Have you not examined the fucking words? Because you've had two good performances and you think, I'm fucking Bertie Big Bollocks tonight. I'll fucking play how I like. But you won't play how you like, because if you play how you like, I'll fucking stick the youth team. So if I'm going to take abuse from a bunch of cockroaches behind me, I'll take abuse by doing it my way. And that is fucking conformity, not fucking non-conformity. So you little cunt, when I tell you to do something, and you fucking big cunt, when I tell you to do something, do it. And if you come back at me, we'll have a fucking right sort out here. All right? And you can pair up if you like, and you can fucking pick someone else to help you, and you can bring your fucking dinner. Because by the time I'm finished with you, you'll fucking need it.
So there we have it. Now, apologies for the language.
One of the finest clips of anything.
I've read a lot about John Sitton over the last couple of days, and I feel very sorry for him. He's now a cabbie. He works as a black cab driver in London.
Wow.
He hasn't worked in football since. I think he's had a couple of jobs in non-league football. I think he was briefly at Enfield and he was briefly at Leighton,
right,
who are a non-league team down the road from Leighton Orient. That was it. He became...
Hang on a minute. There's a team. There's a Leighton Orient and there's a Leighton.
Yes. So I think Leighton played a much, much lower level.
If you're Leighton, you need something after your name as well. Because it just sounds like you've got the word Leighton Orient wrong, or you don't know how to abbreviate teams.
Yeah. That kind of stuff happened in dressing rooms up and down the country, week in, week out. But it had never been televised. So obviously it's before the mobile phone era, before the camera phone era. So none of that stuff was ever leaked. And even the things like Ferguson kicking a boot at David Beckham, you know, that's not been caught on camera. And I still think that there is something for fans quite sacrosanct about dressing rooms. You know, if you haven't played professional sport, there is something quite... there's a mystery to the dressing room because we all want to know what's going on in there, and none of us are privy to it apart from on this documentary. I mean, I read about him. He suffered from depression quite badly after this because he realised that his career was over. But to see a man who is trying to save a club he played for from being relegated just run out of ideas. I'm fighting with one untied behind his back because he's only got a squad of 13 players to choose from.
Well, just offer out the one fella. Yeah. Then he said, and bring him with you, and then bring somebody else, and then bring him dinner. But, okay. He's not pissing about, is he?
He really isn't.
You basically, he says to the one guy, don't bother coming back, go to the job club, basically. And then to his mate, you can probably join him.
It wasn't like, we've all been I've certainly been in changing rooms where there's idle threats bandied around from your coach or your manager. Yeah. Right? But you know, if you're that club in that situation, when he's saying to you, you're out of a fucking job, you're out of a job. He's not messing around, you really are set. And was it? And it was a half time. You've got to go and play the second half knowing you've been sacked. you imagine working in Tesco's, right? You turn up on your break. The manager walks in, Gary Bachelder, in my case, in Barry Tesco, Club Ross Cross Tesco's in the late 80s, right? Gary Bachelder was the boss. If he'd have walked in and said to me, Bubbins, you fucking prick, you're sacked, right? You've got a problem, then I'll fucking take you outside now to the trolley park and bring your mate with you and bring your fucking dinner as well. Right. We're going back on the get back on the checkout. Like, can you imagine going back at work after that?
Also,
fuck off, Gary.
He sacked defender and fan favourite Terry Howard on camera in the dressing room at half time. Terry's an ex-teammate of mine who I like very, very much. He's good company when you go for a night out. As a manager and a coach, he's not what I'm looking for. Oh, I may have lost a friend, but by tomorrow I would have recovered. You cannot believe what you're seeing. But what, I mean, we're still talking about it 25 years later, so it's certainly memorable.
Mike, what have you brought with you for round one of clips?
Stuart Moss passed away today. We're doing this on Sunday. And he's just one of those icons of sport and those icons of as a Brit. I mean, there's a few times when I feel British more than Welsh, right? And when I see people like Daley Thompson and people like Stirling Moss, I feel very British. And just watch this clip. Now, this is 10 years ago, and this is Stirling Moss talking about motor racing and Grand Prix. He was 80 when he recorded this clip. He died today at 90. An absolute hero of British sport, and this is a clip of him a decade ago.
I'm glad that I raced when it was dangerous, because the exhilaration of going round a really fast corner, 140, 150 miles an hour, and knowing that if you go off you might die, sure makes you feel pretty good when you get through it without dying. You know.
So there we go, I just love that sort of glamour of the 50s and the 60s. I think the black and white always helps. When he talks about waving to opponents as he goes past, or when he remembers the shade of lipstick on the pretty girls at Monaco watching the Grand Prix, you know, and what really stuck with me in that interview, and you listen to people like him and other motor racers from that period and a little bit later, when he says he wouldn't want Grand Prix to be dangerous now, of course, he's not a psychopath, right? But he's glad he raced in a time when it was genuinely dangerous.
Yeah.
Right? And you've got to remember, it wasn't like there's a chance you get injured that season. You knew, looking around the paddock, that probably two or three of you would be dead before the end of the season. So he talks, when you're going around that bend at 170 miles an hour in a car with no seatbelt, no roll cage, right?
No seatbelt.
You know, and he just said, he said he was basically that he was terrified.
Yeah.
But when he came out of that, he said the feeling was amazing, that you basically cheated death. But this would be like 6, 7, 8 bends a lap. For like 20, 30, 40 laps of a long season. And then he did rally driving as well. He just loved, he was a born racer, Stirling Moss. And just that embrace, when you see like extreme sportsmen these days, same sort of thing, I suppose, in sportswomen, just to embrace it. But, and I remember Barry Sheen talking about the same thing and James Hunt talking about the same thing. You were mates, but you were like gladiators. You know, you knew for a fact, like I just said, that more than one of you were going to be dead. And you're young men in your 20s, young, good-looking, well-paid men with great lives. It wasn't like you had some shitty life you couldn't wait for it to be over. You had an amazing life, but it was going to be gone like that. So he never won the World Championship. He won a lot of races. He was fantastic. People say he may be the best Formula One driver of all time, although he never said that about himself. That he basically, the one time he had the real chance to win the World Championship, He took himself out of the running, because there was a racer called Mike Hawthorn that he was friends with,
right,
who'd been disqualified in a previous race.
Right.
And if he'd have stayed disqualified, then Stirling Moss would have won the World Championship. Stirling Moss spoke up in his tribunal in defence of him to get his disqualification rescinded. And by doing that, he talked himself out of the World Championship.
Wow.
Wow. I love the fact that in this country, he is still the go-to figure for driving fast.
Absolutely.
So, like, slow down there, Linford tends to be my go-to for someone running fast.
I tweeted it. I said like, to my kids who don't know who he is, he's just the bloke. When I say to Kelly, my wife, if she's driving a little bit too fast for the conditions, I said, easy, Kelly, you're not Stirling Moss. Yeah.
In the same, so my dad's been saying, who do you think you are, Stirling Moss?
Absolutely.
For as long as I can remember. Now, this Stirling Moss retired over 50 years ago. Yeah. You'd think it would be Nigel Mansell.
Yeah.
You'd think it would be Lewis Hamilton obviously. You'd think it could even be Damon Hill. But it's still Stirling Moss, in the same way that if anyone takes a photograph, someone goes, who do you think you are, David Bailey?
Yeah. But he talks about people who are racers, right? And like, I love motorcycle racing as well. And one thing I love about motorcycle racing is there's not that communication between the pit and the bike.
Yeah.
They could do it. They've got the technology, but they don't do it. You hang the boards out there, but if Valentino Rossi or Marquez is riding a motorcycle, they're making the decision. Mm. I'm not saying Hamilton's not a fantastic driver. He obviously is, right? But he's also got a crew saying, save the tyres, come in two laps, do this, slow down, speed up. You've got this much of a lead. And when Moss was doing it, that was just on you. You know, that was on you. So he talks about blokes who were just racers. And he said he couldn't... He mentions about Schumacher, and it's interesting, it's before Schumacher had his big injury, when he said he was a racer. But then he took some time out of racing, and when he came back, he was a very good driver. But he thought he'd lost that. He wasn't a racer anymore.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
When you're driving fast on the motorway, you get that thing in your stomach, don't you? Where you go, ooh, bit too fast, and you ease off.
Yeah.
They either don't have that thing, or they found a way to switch it off.
Or they love it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
So...
Yeah.
When that happens... They embrace it and think, this is what I'm into it for.
I'm right on the edge here. This could go spectacularly wrong. Yeah, I'm right on it.
Wow.
They did a test on Schumacher when he was in his pomp. I think they rigged him up with some like heart rate monitors and things. Just to look how he... Like Al's saying there, when he was going at the sort of speed that you, me or LS would be absolutely... losing control of our functions, right? And I think his heart rate was like 75 beats per minute. You know, it was like he was sat down doing a Times crossword.
Yes.
Because he's just thinking about... He's too busy concentrating on the race and what he needs to do, and, you know, and he's obviously enjoying it. But to have that sort of... We talked to racers who get pinged for speeding off duty when they're in their car. It must be like being a... You know, you're like I say, when a fly sees everything... 20 times slower than...
Yeah.
That's where you can never hit a fly with a newspaper. If you're Stirling Moss, life off the track must seem like a snail's pace all the time.
Yeah.
There's a tendency these days, without making too sweeping a generalisation, that you shouldn't like the fact that the sports are dangerous. You shouldn't like the fact that there is that, you know, that peril and that risk to life and limb. But the fact is, a lot of people, myself included, I do like that. Right,
yeah.
I like to see people push themselves to the absolute limit. I like to see big hits and fast races and you know, I don't want to see crashes and deaths, but I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say, I watch a boxing match, and people try to justify something by saying, well, you know, take the head out of it, so we're just going to have the body shots, and we'll count the body shots, like Olympic style with the front. I don't want to see that. I want to see blokes punching each other in the head. I mean, that's why I watch boxing.
Whether you think it's right or wrong, I think some people will try and deny that it is a part of the human condition, and you can't deny that. You know, people, young men in particular, will always look for danger, and there will always be an audience for... people pushing themselves.
Right, my first clip for this week is one of my favourite basketball players of all time. This is Magic Johnson. I've gone for the All-Star Game, which in themselves are terrible affairs. They're never worth watching. They're never worth existing except for this one in 1992. He had tested positive for HIV in November of 91. This game took place in February of 92.
Seeing some outstanding basketball being played.
Magic Johnson! Boy, he is really sharp for someone who hasn't played at the competitive level. He's worked out considerably, but he's a rate.
If it wasn't for Johnson's own story, the actual game is fantastic as well. So on the one side, you've got Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, Patrick Ewing, Charles Barkley. I think I'm right in saying Dennis Rodman's on the bench to start with Scottie Pippen. And then you've got the subtext of what Magic has been through. So he has tested positive for HIV. He hasn't played since then. And a lot of these guys don't want to be on the same court as him because the world isn't as well informed as perhaps we are now, and a lot of them think they could catch HIV from playing basketball against him. And then there is the moment before the game starts where he sort of high-fives his own team as he comes onto the court, stands down the far end, and then it's Isaiah Thomas, who is a mate of his, but is probably not the most popular member of the NBA at this time. He doesn't get into the dream team in the Olympics because he doesn't get on with Michael Jordan, but he's the first one who comes over from the East team and just gives Magic Johnson a huge hug, and it's just this wonderful kind of life affirming moment.
The commentator says, well, he's been running 4 miles a day, and you think that's not even the right training for basketball.
No, it's a 6K. Yeah.
It's the right training for running 4 miles a day.
I tell you what about is I'm not a big NBA fan, even though I like American things, right?
But
those names you rattled off then, like I know all those players. And when I was watching them come on, I thought, no, I know him.
Yeah.
I know who that is. There was like a real golden period. Maybe it was to do with the Olympics and the Dream Team as well.
Yeah.
But I knew all those players. And obviously Magic Johnson is one of those figures who transcends his sport. And just if you think about how little we knew at that time, right?
Yes.
I remember growing up, you know, in the 80s and the late, when the government things about AIDS came on TV,
yeah.
I thought, shit, everyone's going to die from AIDS.
Yeah.
We're all going to die from AIDS. You know, and no one knew how it was, originally how it was spread and everything else. Even though there was a bit of an understanding at that point of how HIV was passed around, there were still a lot of theories out there, a lot of crackpots and a lot of weirdos, you know. So, you know, and you're playing a game where you're going to sweat and there's going to be contact,
yes,
and there's going to be bodily fluids and there's going to be, you know. So I thought fair play to the players in that, that must have done a massive amount for everyone else with HIV in the world, that thing. That game must have changed attitudes all over the place.
Yeah, and he became an activist for people in America on low incomes who were HIV sufferers and who had AIDS. And the thing with Magic Johnson as well is November 91, that's when Freddie Mercury died.
Yes.
If you look
how
the British tabloid press wrote about Freddie Mercury and his condition,
yeah,
it would nowadays be classed as a hate crime.
Mm,
it was
absolutely
a very, very misunderstood illness. That, and you know, that government information campaign in the UK was you know, incredibly successful, and also is still being, you know, we're proving it's still being talked about 30 years on. But in the early 90s, I knew who he was despite knowing nothing about NBA. I think it was him and Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Jordan, obviously, because of the trainers,
yeah,
to a large extent as well. But they completely transcended sport to the extent that they were household names in the UK, even though that basketball, yeah, is a real still a minority sport. And yet I still,
as
you know, I still
it's
liked
it. Everybody played in school.
Yes.
Like everyone, I played basketball. Everyone I know played basketball. But it's one of those sports that you get to start at 16, everyone stops playing basketball.
Yeah, I often wonder.
That's because I'm a probably middle-class white bloke living in Wales.
You're also not 6 foot nine.
I've been in the hood in Llanfairpwll.
This is a paid advert from BetterHelp Therapy Online. Now, we all carry around lots of different sort of stress moments, whether it's like big or small. It could be as huge as, how am I going to pay the mortgage this month? Or, you know, I'm ill, but I don't really want to talk to anybody about that because I don't want to make them feel stressed about it as well. Or, you know, it could be just something as small as, how am I going to get to school pickup in time? I've got a meeting. How do I change that? How do I move that? I forgot to cancel that. And lots of the time we keep it bottled up. And whether it's big or small, it can really start to affect us negatively. And therapy is kind of a safe space to get those things off your chest. So whether it's like coming up with plans to organise your life a little bit better, or whether it's just having someone to talk to about those things you don't want to stress out your mates or your family with.
If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, accessible, affordable and entirely online. You will be matched with a therapist after filling out a brief survey, and you can switch therapists at any time.
Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/distant. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/distant.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to LibsynAds.com now. That's LibsynAds.com.
Right, you guys have had your choices of documentary, so it's my go this week. And selfishly, I've gone for an entire series. This is The Test, and it is about the Australian cricket team. It's kind of the 18-month period from when Steve Smith and David Warner get done for using sandpaper to manipulate a ball during the test match out in South Africa.
Build a team, right? Going to build a team out of you blokes. Going to keep learning every game we play.
You're away from home. Things are uncomfortable. We've lost. If I'm being honest, I feel shit at us right now.
We can't be fat and we can't be not aggressive.
What do you reckon about the team?
I don't reckon we're really 100% set on our batting lineup yet. That's just the truth.
We're seen as an Australian team that's prepared to roll up their sleeves, have a crack in any situation. That's going to be the way we're going to win our fans back.
I've seen a lot of behind-the-scenes docs, a lot of the ones that you've been talking about, Elle, to do with football from the early days when people were kind of naive to the camera being there. And I've worked on quite a lot as well. And people know you're there because you're the dude with the camera sat in the corner of the room. You can be in a boxing dressing room minutes before someone goes in for a world title fight, and you can be as inobtrusive as you like, but you're still the bloke with a massive camera sat in the corner of the room. And yet this Australian team seem not quite relaxed, but they seem all right with that. And they seem all right with, it's not quite warts and all, but it's pretty close to it. It's as close to it as I've seen in a documentary series.
I've discovered my next obsession, I think, because I only watched the first episode. I watched it last night.
Yeah.
And I could not believe what I was seeing. Yeah. I think it's one of the best sporting documentaries I've seen for a long time. And this week I've binge-watched Sunderland Till I Die.
Yes.
And as behind the scenes and as fly on the wall as it is still stage managed to an extent. There's a bit where one of the players, I can't remember who it is, I think it might be Jack Rodwell actually, is deciding whether he's going to stay at the club or not. And he calls his agent and he says, this is a personal call, and they turn the cameras off. Yeah. And that's it.
All a bit made in Chelsea, isn't it?
Yeah. The footage, the behind the scenes footage they've got hold of on this documentary. You know, they've just been absolutely stuffed by England in a one day international. And it shows Langer giving the entire team a dressing down.
Yeah.
Seconds after they're in off the pitch, off, you know, I just think it's incredible. And also, the thing with the Australian cricket team is that it does sum up a vision of Australianness, or the way they want to see themselves, the way they want to portray themselves to the world, in a way that, to an extent, I think Aussie Rules used to. Because I did a tour of Australia about 10 years ago, and there was a scandal in Aussie Rules, and I remember talking to someone and she said that they used to be people that the whole country looked up to, and after this scandal I'm not sure that's the case anymore, but they still think that way about the Australian cricket team. So obviously the ball tampering scandal is such a huge issue. Yeah. The Prime Minister got involved.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Well, I sent Steph a message after I watched the first two. I watched them today back to back, the first two episodes. one of the, I don't know if we say this every week, but honestly, no, that is one of the best docs. I literally can't wait to see the restaurant. Like, the first two were fantastic. And like you said there, Al, like, with Justin Langer, obviously, he played at the top level. He's such a quiet man, such a well-spoken man. And when he takes over the team, I mean, and I'm a sucker for this sort of thing anyway, doesn't go into a lot of tactics or a lot of, he says the first thing we've got to do is make Australia proud of us again. He talks about, you know, Tim Payne talks about when you made Australian cricket captain, he said, you're basically the second most important person in Australia after the Prime Minister, yeah. Right? It's sort of that big. And he wanted to instill this pride in them being Australians and representing the country again and play and be humble. And you know, I love that in sport. I can't stand, there's cockiness and there's being a cock, right? I can't stand people who are a cock in sport, right? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
The bit when he takes them on their first, they're going to England and they stop off on the way, they go to the Western Front.
Yes.
To look at all the Anzac graves there and say what these, and he's not trying to draw parallels and saying that, you know, we're as important as you know, the thousands of young lads who died there, but he's just saying, listen, these are Australians. This is part of our national history, and remember that we're representing this country, right? Be proud of this. But then, where it really bites you in the bum as a doc, well, I love cricket, but I'd sort of forgotten that because I was so carried away with the World Cup. Yeah. I'd sort of forgotten the tour before that.
Yeah,
and like you said, they got smashed. Yes. They got beaten 5-0 in the one series.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they were getting tonked. And then after the game, the cameras are there talking to Langer, talking to Tim Payne, talking to people right after the... Oh, for Christ.
Yeah.
I can't believe what I was seeing.
The Australian Cricket Board aren't naive.
No.
So the amount of coverage, the amount of access they get, I don't know how that happened in 2018. Because you'd think that... In the modern era, it just wouldn't be possible to make this kind of documentary.
They were so low, though, weren't they? They were so low.
They had literally no... After that ball tampering, when you watch... It's heartbreaking. Like I said, the worst thing about... We talked about this briefly earlier. The worst thing about the doc for me is I hate loving Australia.
Yeah.
Right? I'm loving Aussies watching this. I'm loving...
Yeah, yeah.
They were so low, like Steph said then, right? After the ball tampering, it was huge over there. And when you see... When you saw... What's his name? Steve Smith.
Yes.
Crying like a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to just give him a cutch. I felt so bad for him. So I think that when they must have approached the Australian Cricket Board, they went, "Well, we can only go up."
Well, Steve Smith goes back into the squad, and they ask Justin Langer in one of the set piece interviews, "What's he like?" And he just went, "He's weird, mate. He's really weird." And this is like, this is your former captain coming back in, absolute hero. He just went, "Yeah, he's just a really strange man, if I'm honest." And I love that level of honesty. And then the Headingley test, which I know was kind of back on the telly yesterday, the whole Ben Stokes innings where he wins it from nowhere. Watching that, watching Justin Langer watch that is one of the most fantastic pieces of telly you will ever see, because they win that, they retain the Ashes, and they need to get one wicket, and they've got Jack Leach in there and he cannot bat. And yet they can't keep him on strike because Tim Payne keeps messing it up. And so he's slagging off his captain, saying, "What's his field position here?" And then there's a moment where the ball comes into Nathan Lyons and there's a chance of a stumping, of a run out, rather.
Oh, superb.
And it cuts to Langer and he kicks over the bin in the back of the box. And even as he's done it, because he's this mild-mannered, quite zen guy, it all kind of cascades down the stairs. And the bin hasn't hit the ground before he starts picking up every single piece of litter that's fallen out of that bin. He starts putting it back in one by one. Still really annoyed, but aware that that's not what I should have done. Right, that's on Amazon Prime. It's called The Test. If you sign up for Amazon while you're stuck indoors, you get 30 free days with it, and then you can do what you like. You can
watch it,
pile through the documentaries, or you can cancel it as soon as you want to. Your choice. Right, second round of clips for this week. Mike, you're first up with this one because your clips for this week are as polar opposites as you can get.
Well, I'll let this clip speak for itself. To say that I was obsessed with this documentary about Paul Sykes when it came out, and I have been obsessed with it for probably 30 years, is an understatement. And Ellis knows this firsthand. I know we're a sports podcast, but I'm putting this in there because he was a boxer. He boxed briefly professionally. I think this is genuinely one of the best monologues of 90 seconds or less, right, that I've ever heard in my life. And, well, just watch this and then we'll have a chat.
I'm a wonderful citizen. How do you think I've got this house and where I'm living now if I wasn't? They've given me this council. We've got the best, this is the best little city on earth. How do I know? I've been everywhere else. I'm here now, right on the family patch. Yeah, I know where it is. I've been. Nobody can tell me anything. I don't read Daily Mirror and Sun. I go and have a look and I've been. I've lived in the forests of North America. I've lived in the outback of the Ivory Coast. I've lived in India and Russia. I had my breakfast in Moscow and my tea in Wood Street, Nick. Yeah, I've been about a bit. I'm the only man in the history of mankind that has swum across the Straits of Johor. I had to avoid a police launch. It was either that or Tianjin. They've got me to passport in Singapore. Yeah, I swam it. Yeah, nobody's ever done it before. Not because of the currents or anything like that. Nothing like that. It's sharks. It's not shark infested, but none of the locals go paddling. Yeah, I swam it. I know about sharks, yeah. I'm 6'3" and 16 stone, 200 weight, yeah. I'm swimming.
I mean, that these is, pumps, to me, that's as good as it gets. That is as good as it gets. Oh, I wrote a thing a while back, probably when I just started doing comedy.
Right.
And I wanted to write this real nutcase. And I actually asked Alice, because I just started doing comedy and I met Al and we got on. I asked Al to play this lunatic that I based wholly on Paul Sutton. And I've got to say, Alice did a fantastic job of it. But I think that bit, when he's not a shark infested, right? I just, it's so good. And that whole, if you get a chance, I think it's in like six parts on YouTube.
Yeah.
Right? They haven't got the whole thing there, but you can find all the parts together. Watch that, because, I mean, quite a tragic story in the end, obviously, right? I mean, he had a lot of alcohol and drug issues and, Paul Sykes.
He fought for a Commonwealth and a British title.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. Okay, I didn't realise. I knew he'd only had a few fights.
He used to spar with a Welsh guy from Newport called David Price, who was British champion.
Yeah.
So he used to be one of his sparring partners. I think he said that Price was sort of the toughest guy he'd ever sparred with. But I think that's sort of, he was a really decent level.
Paul Sykes was also basically Britain's most notorious inmate for a long time. You know, he was infamous, and then obviously became famous because of this documentary.
There's a bit there with his old man who's a prison guard, right? Obviously a lot of it stems from that relationship with his dad, without being too much of an amateur psychologist. But he goes, I'll paraphrase it because I haven't seen it for a few months. He goes, "My dad's a bastard, but I'm the only one that can call him that." Right, I just think that is sweet as, and then his mum looks like she's been drawn by the people who draw Viz, right? You see his mum chatting, and she's a great character herself, right? And it was maybe an hour long on BBC Two, probably in the mid or late 80s, and it's one of those things. There was that, and there was a documentary called John's Not Mad, and they were the two docs. Anyone my age remembers those two docs, but the one with Paul Sykes. There's a bit there when he gets married and he asks a mate of his from prison, who's now come out and he's a reformed character and he's done his whatever you call vicar training, right? He's done his vicar GCSE, and he's now a vicar, right? So he's doing the ceremony in Paul's front room, and then Paul, it becomes incandescent with the bloke because he mentions God. He's just like, God's got nothing to do with it, right? If I want to, no book can tell me what to do. You're like, he's a vicar. You've asked him to come to your house as a vicar, right? He's just, and he runs. If you watch the doc, he ends up running a running club for kids in the area. and he goes, "I want you to bring your kids to me, and I'll look after them for you." I thought, my God, imagine like dropping your kids off at Paul Sykes for the afternoon.
That bit though, where he's talking about swimming.
Yes.
You know, because with his trainers tied round his neck.
I'm 6'3".
200
14 stone, 200 weight.
He warms to his theme as the story becomes more and more elaborate. And as someone with a...
Yeah, well, that was going on out in Changi, Nick.
As someone with a five-year-old daughter, it is still reminiscent of when a five-year-old riffs to get out of trouble. There's a really fantastic Richard Pryor routine where he talks about the lies his kids tell to get out of trouble. Yeah. And they spiral and they make less and less sense. And that is him. But because he's so scary, you have to believe him.
So, he's one of those blokes, and we all know someone like it, right? And I think Robert Carlyle, like Begbie, when he plays Begbie, someone who's an absolute hair trigger.
I know
a few sports people, I'm not going to name names, right? But I'll text you later and you'll know what I mean anyway, right?
I think I know who you're going to say.
They would be great company, and they'd be great to have a beer with, but you would know that at any second, they could break your jaw, right?
And
Stefan has absolutely smashed it.
Yes,
We're on Zoom, and Stefan knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Steph's just written on a pad of paper, and that was my guess.
That is the person. Yes.
But yeah, and if they when they walk into the pub, you used to think, okay, he's here, so I'll probably slow down. I probably won't drink as much because if I say something fairly innocuous. He's going to push me up against the wall and I have to defend myself for saying something that I think is fairly run-of-the-mill. And that is how I imagine Paul Sykes was. A real laugh, my God, if he went.
But it's like when you watch like Oliver Reed or any of those great bloody Hellraisers, you know, from the classic. I would love a night. I mean, talk about Stirling Moss embracing it.
Mm.
Bloody hell, I would have loved a night out with Paul Sykes in the 80s. I would have loved it. And then if I'd survived it, I'd have thought, whoa, what a roller coaster. It would have been... Do you know what I mean?
So, Ellis, your choice for round number two is, again, just wonderful to watch.
This is a clip from an Aston Villa video from 1995-1996. And it is the Villa team who, if you're around then, you would still recognise a lot of the players. Tommy Johnson, Gareth Southgate, Paul McGrath, of course, Steve Staunton. Nigel Spink, who'd won a European Cup with Villa in 82. They're all discussing their favourite foods and their favourite drinks.
Favourite food's got to be chicken and pasta.
Italian football is something that, you know, with the pasta and being a footballer, you have to eat that pasta thing that you get used to. But I enjoy Italian as well, but if I have a choice, I'll have Chinese every day of the week if I could.
Maybe have a pizza or something that would be on a Sunday where I let my body sort of recuperate and to rest and to sort of change the system around. But for the 6 days a week or even 7 days a week, I mean, I'll have, a low-fat pizza or something like that, or a few biscuits and some milk on a Sunday. But for the majority part of the week, it's more of a necessity.
I like Italian food, and that'd be my first, probably Chinese second.
Chinese, the favourite food, pasta. Burgers and chips.
Now, this is around the time of the Arsene Wenger revolution. And I think a lot of fans, especially younger fans, when you hear players saying, and Wenger made Tony Adams eat broccoli, they think that's a joke.
Yes.
They think that, well, surely, as professional athletes, they were eating broccoli anyway. Oh. Now, I cannot emphasise enough how much of a cultural sea change that was in British football. And this clip is all the evidence you need. So, the drinks. Southgate is the only one who says water.
Yes.
So if it's not alcoholic, it's Ribena or lemonade. They're athletes. Or Coke. Mark Bosnich, because his body is a temple, spends the week eating low-fat pizzas. Yes. What the hell are they?
Low-fat pizzas.
You've got...
It's got cheese on it. That's entirely
you've got Andy Townsend saying, I'm too old to eat modern health foods like pasta. Come on, mate.
Brought back from China by Marco Polo 2,000 years ago.
You're playing in the Premier League. But the Premier League.
The Bosnich bit where he goes, and on a Sunday, I might have milk and biscuits.
Like he's a three-year-old.
To let my body recharge. I just cannot believe footballers were all doing that. Like, you talk to someone like Ian Stone, who's a stand-up comic, Mike will know him, who does a brilliant Arsenal podcast and is now quite a recognised Arsenal fan. I mean, Stoney's of an age where that really brilliant Arsenal team, especially the George Graham side, they won the league in 91. I think they only conceded 18 goals. What a team. They would finish by 4:45.
They were drinking twice a week.
They'd have a shower. Well, that's where the Tuesday Club comes from. It was an all-dayer that you had to go on. An all-dayer that you had to go on.
You have to go.
They were all in the Arsenal Tavern by 6 o'clock. They were all hammered by 11 p.m.
You can't tell me that football wasn't as good or as entertaining. And certainly that there wasn't a real connection with the fans like there was when blokes were going out and having a drink and eating pizzas and fish and chips and bloody, you know what I mean?
Far more of a connection with the supporters. Absolutely. I think every now... Troy Deeney, for example, I think is someone who, when you look at his background and the way he speaks, is fairly representative of normal supporters.
Yeah.
And then I read a long interview with him a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about how now all of his meals are managed for him and he has a chef and he's got into bone broth and all this kind of stuff and different supplements. You know, Harry Kane is a chef. All the top players have chefs.
Do you know what, though, Al? Right? I'll use a football reference and it's Wales. You like this, right? I was watching that, Cliff Jones the other day.
Yes.
doing his isolation workout.
Yes.
Amazing.
He's 85.
Oh, mate, he's doing proper burpees. Like he does like 10 burpees, and then he's just talking to the camera like it's nothing.
Yeah.
I would be knackered after 10 burpees now.
Yeah.
He's still in great shape. You've got a lot of these I think if you're a bodybuilder and you need to show every striation and every muscle and everything else, I can understand where you've got that strict diet, right?
Yeah.
If you're a jockey who's got to make a weight or a motor racing driver who's got to make a weight or a boxer that's got to make a weight, that's fair enough. If you're a sportsman, if you want to train your bollocks off, right, and train hard and be really skillful, have a drink, have a pizza, have a burger. It doesn't make a difference carrying that bit of extra poundage. Right? I'm not just saying that because I'm a fat bloke, right? I genuinely believe that. I remember the Aussie rugby league team came over about 20 years ago, and there was a thing in the paper about how much beer they drank, because they would drink gallons of beer all the time. And they're saying, there's a lot of bullshit came out that it dehydrates you because it's got alcohol in it. That's bollocks. I mean, it might slightly dehydrate, you know, but you're taking in like 5 litres of fluid. It doesn't dehydrate you 5 litres of body fluid.
Well,
right?
Arsene Wenger could not believe the culture of the drinking culture of British football.
Shouldn't have changed that. They always mention on the news about fucking politicians tell them, like, you know, we need to develop a continental drinking culture. Why? We've got a fucking British drinking culture. That's what we do it this way. Thank you very much. Right? If you come from here from France, get them in and shut up. Because that's not the way we do things.
But also, the thing with Wenger is he would say, right then, when Tony Adams...
Would you like to go with him or George Graham for a night out?
When Tony Adams famously admitted to the squad that he was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And he burst into tears.
Hmm.
And the first one to say anything was Merson, who said, well, if you're an alcoholic, what does that make me? And the entire squad all looked at each other because they were all drinking far too heavily.
Yeah.
And the same at United as well. That was one of the things Ferguson had
as
to
a
do
postscript, because, he is an alcoholic.
Yes, yeah. But,
as it turns out.
What does that make me? An alcoholic.
But Ferguson had to do the same at United. So he kept a few of the big drinkers. Hughes was a big drinker. Robson was a big drinker. But McGrath
was there,
Whiteside, he moved on. Now, Wenger just could not believe what he was seeing.
Well,
so,
he's French, mate. They don't believe like that.
But
that's
he would say stuff like, he would say, listen, guys, he would say, if you've got to do something bad to your body, I would prefer it if you smoked. Because you're just... And like Paulo Di Canio was one of the first really brilliant foreign imports into the Premier League in the mid-90s. I saw an interview with him once where Neil Ruddock would come into training and say, oh, I'm a bit hungover. I had 14 pints yesterday. And Paolo Di Canio would say, why?
Yeah, but he's also a fascist. So.
We're playing Spurs on Saturday. It's a really big game. And I think it is easy for younger football fans.
I'm not glorifying alcoholism. I'm not saying being alcoholic. I'm just saying there's so much put into now into diet and micromanaging grams of carbs and protein and this. And for football, I'm saying it's not important.
But also, if you want to win, if anyone is doing that, they will win. That was an enormous advantage that Arsenal had. The fact that they were fitter. And also, if you retained that British drinking culture in the UK, the British teams would get absolutely stuffed by the Italians and the Spanish.
I don't think that's the case.
Because the top players don't drink. You know, Bale is teetotal.
Oh, wow.
You know, it would be more fun, but we'd get hammered.
I don't think we'd get hammered. What? Do you know what? I remember talking to Charlie Faulkner, old British Lion and Wales prop years ago, right? And he was saying that I think they were over in Japan in like 71 or 72. And they got tested. Before sports testing was done, they got tested for cardio fitness and VO2 max and all this other stuff, right? And him telling me, this was 20 years ago, but that the sort of results they achieved had never been bettered by a Welsh team since, right? And those blokes were steel workers and coal miners, and they had manual jobs, and some of them had office jobs, but they trained their tits off. You listen to the boys talking about Poole Park in the old days, running up and down mountains, and you know, they trained and trained and trained and worked hard as well, right? And then they like to have a drink and a pie and chips and a flipping pasty, whatever they want to do, right? So what I'm saying is, I don't think it's the case that Italian teams would beat us because they're having broccoli if we were having pie and chips. I think that's bollocks.
I just think that science would probably prove you wrong.
Science, right? Mate. I did a science degree.
Come around here with science.
Fucking science. It's not the Tour de France. I was thinking about the Tour de France. They're working out the wattage needed to go through a certain stage.
Yeah.
So how many calories you need to take in. And football's not like that. Look at Jan Molby. What a wonderful midfield general, right?
If you're the kind...
Living off prison kind of food with a beer belly.
If you play the kind
magic.
Of... If you play the kind of football Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool play, you've got to be fit to maintain that.
But you can be fit and drink, that's what I'm saying.
Could Trent Alexander-Arnold run up and down that flank having had 8 pints every night
of
grosh,
yes,
and only Chinese food?
I also think it would affect your training as well. You can't retrain.
You can overtrain, mate. You can overtrain.
I think
we'll have to agree to disagree on this.
I'm not saying being alcoholic. I'm not saying I have Chinese food 7 days a week, right? I'm just saying when you see blokes, Premier League footballers, getting pat by some prick with a phone for having a pint on a Wednesday, that's not a big deal.
There is no way. I refuse to accept that Jordan Henderson isn't fitter than Jan Molby.
Would you rather get a pass off Jan Molby or John Henderson?
Okay.
Exactly.
I'd love it if
Your silence speaks volumes. I'm going to say, the beers are kicking in. I've got to tone it down a bit now, sorry.
Right.
I'm on a right, George.
I'm going opposite end of the sporting spectrum for choice number two for me. This is Serena Williams at the 2012 Olympic Games.
Gold medal point. Gold medal point in just a little over an hour. Began with three aces, finished with aces. Gold medal to Serena Williams over Maria Sharapova. 6-love, 6-1. And that is...
This is kind of a weird choice for Serena Williams because you go, OK, Olympics, that's not really a huge deal in the world of tennis. But for her, it was a huge deal. So the approach that she had to the 2012 Olympics was, I need to win this to be as good, in her own mind, as Steffi Graf, Andre Agassi, the guys who'd won the Olympic gold and the four Grand Slam titles. I think she'd won all four of the Grand Slams by 2003, but the Olympics, for whatever reason, I think there was an injury in 2004, quarterfinals in 2008. It just hadn't happened for her. And this was kind of, it wasn't her last chance because she went to Rio as well, but that didn't go away. So this one was just a demolition of everyone who she faced. So it was at Wimbledon on the grass there. She played 6 matches. She only dropped 17 games in the entire tournament. That's ludicrous. And she's a sports person who just gets not overlooked, but people will mention male tennis players before they mention Serena Williams. And she is way ahead of everyone else in her era.
The thing with Serena is, growing up, I caught the tail end of Navratilova's dominance.
Yes.
And then Steffi Graf. Mm-hmm. And I think it is quite easy to think when you're in the period, especially if it's when you're discovering sport in general, if you're growing up, if your formative years have a really dominant player, I think it's easy to think, well, we'll never see the likes of her again.
Yeah.
But Serena, and also her sister, what a set of genetics that family have,
yes.
By the way. 12 Wimbledon titles between them. They're the top two earning tennis players of all time.
Yeah.
Two sisters. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's the Venus and Serena age.
It's just that story, mate, as well, of how they were sort of, you know, blue-collar, West Coast, you know, not the sort of... there's a real sort of snobbery, whether it's deserved or not these days, but there certainly was a real snobbery with tennis. For them to come into that, and for their dad to think, you know, to actually understand of what, you know, you're a black woman in America.
Yeah.
There's going to be a glass ceiling at some point, which is obviously wrong and bang out of order. But to think that how can my daughters achieve greatness, right? And that obviously, I think he was... quite a strict coach, you listen to it. But, like you said, for two sisters to dominate a sport like that was remarkable.
She also, Serena, won the Australian Open when she was 8 weeks pregnant.
Yes.
She didn't, did she?
Yeah.
She did.
Oh, God.
That is just mind-boggling. It is absolutely mind-boggling. She put a thing on Instagram to say that she to announce that she was 20 weeks pregnant, and then everyone did the maths and realised she'd won the Australian Open when she was 8 weeks pregnant.
Oh my God.
Just insane. And the first trimester as well is when you're at your most tired. The idea of playing tennis in the first trimester is just... I just can't get my
And also,
head
do you know what? I mean, I'm not a huge tennis fan. You'd be surprised to hear this, but I much prefer tennis in the sort of early 80s, mid-80s.
Yeah.
But I think modern tennis, modern rackets, the way it's played, I'd much rather watch women's tennis than men's tennis.
Yeah.
I just think it's more entertaining. I think the skill levels are higher. It's not all about one massive big serve, okay?
I think it's
a better game to watch.
I think Sampras era, I would agree with you. I think
Rozetsky is a good example of that.
Yeah, I think that era player. I didn't like at all. I think the era before it, Becker, Edberg, brilliant. I like the sort of four... guy dominance that there has been.
Nadal,
Federer, Djokovic and Murray. Mm. I've got back into tennis.
Do you know what? Here's an aside. I'm trying to think of another sport where you have a second chance. You know, where you can try and hit that as hard as you can, right? But if you miss it, because you've gone for it too much, you'll say, oh, don't worry about it, have another go. Right? It doesn't happen in... Imagine taking a... Really trying to blast a penalty, really not do a proper Roy of the Rovers.
Yeah.
And because you've tried to hit it too hard, it's gone over the crossbar, the refs can't have another goal, go on. Or golf. You know, you've got to try and drive a par four to get an eagle. So you really lash at it, put it out of bounds, and you go... And the marshal goes, go on, have another one.
That's
another
interesting.
One. That's a very, very good... Well, off the top of my head in football, when I think of retaken free kicks... I think of Gareth Bale's one against Andorra, which he scored and rescued Wales' qualification. I think of the Koeman one against England in 93, which obviously is retaken, and then he scores and it scuppers England's chances. Because by then, you've given two fantastic free kick takers a chance to get their eye in.
Yeah.
If footballers were given two attempts at a free kick...
You imagine
kick.
Sailing a penalty, right? You have two goes of this.
Yeah, yeah.
The first one, you're going to absolutely lash it.
Yeah.
Or try something outrageous. Because, you know, if that misses, I'll just go for my normal penalty.
There will be some obscure...
There will be someone cleverer than us.
I think I've revolutionised tennis.
That's played in Tasmania.
Two pints in, I've revolutionised.
You're the second Welshman. Did you know there was a guy called Mike Davis who brought in... He's in the Tennis
second,
Hall of Fame.
He brought in the second serve, did he?
No, he did. No. He brought in the tiebreak.
Oh, did he?
For TV purposes. And he
brought... Can I bring in this?
He brought in the yellow balls... because they couldn't see the white balls on TV.
Well, I'm obviously the heir apparent of Mike Davis.
There you go. Two Welshmen revolutionising tennis. Right, book choices for this week, gentlemen. Let's go, Mike, first of all. What have you got for us?
Right, this is, I love this. I bought this book in Hay-on-Wye Book Festival a while back, probably 10 years ago now. I was just, there's obviously loads of brilliant old bookstores. They're all secondhand bookstores. And I found this Green Bay Diary by Jerry Kramer, who played, he played guard for the Packers in the glory days of the 60s. And just really, really interesting to read a 60s sportsman's account of that year. And it was the year leading up to Super Bowl I. And the Packers in the 60s, probably the best team that ever played football. So they won six championships in 10 years. Coached by Vince Lombardi. We talk about people who are bigger than their sport, right? I think every sort of football manager, every coach, everyone involved in coaching sport will know a little bit about Vince Lombardi at least. Just an amazing coach. So it's really interesting to listen to Jerry Kramer talking about that year with Lombardi leading up to Super Bowl I. And as a little aside to it, Jerry Kramer got in the Hall of Fame, I think it was last year or year before, but there'd been a sort of 40 plus year campaign to try and get Jerry Kramer into the Hall of Fame, led by his daughter. And the theory, one of the theories why he wasn't in the Hall of Fame was that Packers team was so good and Lombardi was so brilliant that Lombardi was in the Hall of Fame, and I think 11 or 12 Packers from that team were already in the Hall of Fame, which is, you know, it's unrivaled. But they said that the one of the schools of thought was that because Lombardi was so good, the players didn't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame because he would have put anybody in the Hall of Fame because he was such a tactician,
right?
Which is obviously, I mean... But he's in there now, Jerry Kramer. And the other theory was that because he'd written this diary, and it's not warts and all by a long stretch of the imagination, but it's quite a real account of what it was like, that he'd upset people in the NFL, and there was like this unwritten agreement that he would never be in the Hall of Fame. But you think of the NFL now, and boys who are making $20, $30, $40 million a year. I know Al's the same with football, right? In those days, boys all had a job. I mean, this wasn't ancient history. This is 50 years ago. So unless you were the quarterback, you know, you'd be on the big, big bucks. People like Jerry Kramer, even though they were world champions in the American version, which is they were Super Bowl champions, players were just seen as commodities in the team. And they weren't making the sort of life-changing money that they make now. There's a great story about the Packers had a fantastic player called Jim Taylor. Now, Vince Lombardi had a policy of never talking to agents. He didn't believe in agents. He thought agents ruined football.
Okay.
He was a very strict Catholic. He went to Mass every day. Very religious man. He thought that money, and especially agents, were ruining the sport that he loved. And he played it, you know, he was a very good player as a younger man. So he had a no agents rule. And now, after they won the Super Bowl, I think Jimmy Taylor was due a new contract. His contract was up. So he turns up, now he was their star running back. He turns up at his meeting to talk about his new contract with an agent. So Vince Lombardi walks out. It wasn't the general manager, it was him. He did all this himself. Lombardi walks into the waiting room there and says, Jimmy, he says, oh, I'm not going to talk to you, Mr. Lombardi. He says, this is my agent. You know, he's going to negotiate on my behalf. So Lombardi says, just wait there for a second. Goes back in his room. So Jim Taylor sort of sits there. Super Bowl winning star running back. He said 5 minutes later, Lombardi walks out in the changing room. Jimmy Taylor, they got to stand up. And he says to the agent, if you want to talk about Jim's contract, you need to speak to the New Orleans Saints because he no longer plays for the Green Bay Packers. And he'd gone in and traded him. He'd gone into the room, picked up the telephone and got rid of him.
Wow.
Okay, Alice, what's your book, mate?
Well, the book I have chosen is Those Feet, An Intimate History of English Football by David Winner. Now, football in particular, more than any sport, I think, is well catered for when it comes to histories. There's a cracking book called The Ball Is Round, A Global History of Football by David Goldblatt, which is just shy of 1,000 pages long and is pretty academic, but it's, you know... if it's not in that book, it's not worth knowing. But this book, Those Feet by David Winner, is much more readable, much shorter, very entertaining, and is also, I'm going to read it out to you, contains probably my favourite football anecdote of all time, which I think is right up Mike Bubbins' street. So here we go. This is talking about how tough players had to be in the old days in comparison with now. Strength and the ability to withstand punishment was still more essential when football was even tougher in the 1920s and 1930s. Dixie Dean of Everton, statistically the greatest goal scorer in the history of the English game, lost a testicle at the age of 17. Whoa. When playing for Tranmere in a reserve match. Dean had angered the opposing centre-half, one David Parks, by scoring twice. As Dean passed him going down the field, the two bantered. Parks, get no more bloody goals today, you finished. Dean, by the looks of you, you've finished, you've had it. Next time Dean got too near Parks, the defender kicked him with full force in the groin. In hospital, Dean was strapped to a table while his balls swelled.
Shut up.
And then was given gas while surgeons removed the damaged organ.
Oh.
Now get this, right?
Oh,
after 5 weeks, he was back on the field. And the injury didn't affect either his football or his ability to go on to father four children. Dean, of course, scored 60 goals in one season. Now, this is a bit I think Mike will like. Mm. 17 years later, Dean was in a pub in Chester when a stranger sent him a pint across the bar. He stared at the man's face for a while before it dawned on him that the man was Davy Parks. Dean strode over and greeted his former assailant with a savage beating. I'd done his face up and they took him to the hospital. So we're evens, Dean recalled in a raging interview in 1978. It was the only time that I ever retaliated.
15 years after the event.
I really thought you were going to say
best mates.
He took a pint and they spent the evening together. He beat the life out of him.
17 years later. During his later career, Dean played with a metal plate in his head, the result of a life-threatening motorcycle accident, which left him with a broken skull and a fractured jaw.
You know what though, mate? Revenge is a dish best served cold.
Can you?
Wow.
So this book is
17 years ago. You kicked my nuts off. Have this. I love that. That's one of the that's one of the best twists to the end of a story.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought, here we go. And now he's the godson. He's the godfather of my children.
Exactly. Yeah. No.
No. I'm in the hospital.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read Valley of Fear, the Sherlock Holmes book, but I would say that is a better twist than Valley of Fear, which is an absolute belter, if you like, a detective fiction.
Last week you mentioned when you were talking about Steve Robinson, a guy called Colin McMillan, Sweet C.
Yeah.
And my book this week is This Bloody Mary Is the Last Thing I Own, by a guy called Jonathan Rendell.
One of my favourite books.
Which is a great title. And Jonathan Rendell is, I guess, a modern-day kind of gonzo writer, or is that to do him a disservice?
Yes.
Is that all right? Is that acceptable?
I think so. I've read lots of books on boxing, and I think that is probably the most authentic depiction of what boxing is like.
For me.
Because at no point does it make boxing look glamorous.
Absolutely. So he becomes a manager, but at no point is he flush with money as a result of this. At no point does any of it sound like it was something you'd want to be involved in, but he is incredibly involved in it. Some of his other work around gambling, he wrote a book which then became a TV series on Channel 4 called The Gambler. He eventually kind of died destitute in 2013.
Yeah, a young man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Young man.
And, you know, a lot of people will view it as a wasted talent and perhaps not something to celebrate. But the actual writing within this is beautiful, and the story within it, where he's going to Vegas for fights and he's staying not on the strip, but in those sort of off-strip, terrible motels and kind of hanging out with not the celebrity singers, but the looky-likey celebrity singers.
All right, mate, all right.
He won the Somerset Maugham Award.
He did.
For writing.
Yes.
But as someone who is fascinated by boxing, it is at times a chilling read.
Yeah.
And a very, very uncomfortable read, because, you know, he doesn't hold back. It's a really, really savage book, but it's well worth reading.
Oh, it's a kind of beautiful in a way. Right, that's pretty much us for this week, guys. We have a few guesses in for The Secret Guitarist. If you want to guess, then if the podcast supplier that you go with allows you to write a review, give us a 5-star rating and leave a review, which is basically a guess. FLDSTRD, which for those listeners who've been with us since week one will know that's my kind of handle, says
yeah.
Dave Edmonds is his choice. Jamie Roberts has been guessed by quite a few people recently.
What, the rugby player?
Yes. Very decent guitarist.
I thought he was a pianist.
No, but I think he's trying to learn the piano at the moment during the lockdown. Whilst because also working for the NHS.
He's also gone back to being a doctor.
He has. So hats off to you for that, Jamie.
Yeah, indeed.
But he's been on stage with the Mannix a couple of times.
Yeah.
Has he?
Yes.
Wow.
On a couple of their rugby tour ones, Lions tour, and I think during the World Cup just gone as well.
Nothing over apart from the fact he plays rugby for Wales, the British Lions. He's good looking. He's 6'4". And he's played on stage with the Mannix.
He's got an MPhil from Cambridge as well, isn't he? He's a very, very clever bloke.
I just hope he's got... You just dream of having a tiny willy, but I doubt he has.
I doubt it. I really doubt it. Liam Walker says Graham Coxon. And Big Deeks says that chap Ellis used to stalk from the band Gorky's...
Zygotic Monkey.
Aros from the Gorky's. I'm not at liberty to say if it's him or John Lawrence, the first guitarist. I'm not at liberty to say.
That's fine. That's all good.
I'm not at liberty to
have a listen to it under us now and have yourselves a guess. Right, gentlemen, thank you as always. We shall be back with another one next week.
Cheers, Steph. Cheers, Al.
Cheers, Mike. Thank you, Steph.